Right now, I'm standing in a hole. A 300-foot deep hole, to be exact. But even though I'm down here, I'm still connected to the entire job site. Because I have the new Sprint Direct Connect with apps like Workforce Locator. That lets me know my foreman, Mike, is...
Yeah, I'm here.
And I have three times the coverage, so I know that my most important delivery...
Just arrived.
And as part of the fastest push-to-talk, I can assemble my team the moment I need them. Guys?
On our way.
So now I can focus on turning this hole into a hotel.
Upgrade to the new Done. The new Sprint Direct Connect with three times the coverage and access to the fastest push-to-talk experience nationwide. Now when you buy one Motorola Admiral Rugged smartphone for $49.99, you'll get one free. To upgrade, call 800-SPRINT-1 or visit a Sprint store near you. Offer ends 1/10/13. Offer available to corporate liable accounts. Excludes taxes. Two-year agreement. $36 activation. Up to $350 early termination fee for devices. Fastest claim based on initial setup time for push-to-talk calls originating in Nextel or Sprint-owned 3G coverage. Coverage claim based on comparison of Nextel National Network square miles to Sprint National Network inclusive of roaming. Restrictions apply. See store.
What's your plan B? Is what you're doing taking you toward or away from your goals? Are you fulfilled? You can start over. The past is the past. This is a revolution of hope. We provide a way for extra income part or full-time with a mission and vision of hope designed to inspire. This is the greatest movement on earth. Make a commitment to yourself and ask, what do you want your life to be like? Join us in our revolution of hope. Go to tellmeplanb.com or call 803-431-0775.
And now, the show that covers politics from all angles, Inside Politics with David Kalib.
And you are Inside Politics with David Kalib, the show that covers the issues that affect you. And hope everybody's having a great Tuesday, a great Tuesday evening. And we've got a great Tuesday show lined up. But before we get into tonight's show, one of the jurors in the Zimmerman Trayvon Martin trial did an interview, and there were some shocking things this juror said. And we'll get to that later in the show. But also North Carolina has been doing some outrageous things in the last couple of months. Well, since this Governor McCrory took over. And they've tried to push through a voter ID bill recently, an immigration bill, regressive tax policies that we'll get to in a second. Also, just abortion bills, just like we saw in Texas. North Carolina, they even try to propose a flat tax, which would hurt the poor, which, you know, is just outrageous. North Carolina has become just one of the most radical right-wing states over the last couple of months, especially last year or two. And the most recent outrageous bill is a tax policy that would give people that make over $1 million in the state of North Carolina a tax cut of over $10,000. And corporations would pay 1%, close to 1% less over the next year, 2% less over the next 2 years. So millionaires get over a $10,000 tax cut. Corporations get 2% tax cuts and tax cut reduction, while the middle class would see their taxes go up. And they cut a tax credit for a working family's tax credit that benefited over 900,000 families in the state of North Carolina. So this just tells you about what the Republicans do when they're in control of a state. They're in control of North Carolina, and they're putting a tax policy that helps corporations, 2% cut in taxes, $10,000 cut tax for millionaires, which should be increasing, not decreasing, and cutting a tax credit, which helps over 900,000 families in North Carolina. If that doesn't tell you the difference in parties, I don't know what will. Regressive tax policies indeed. But tonight, it's all about Walmart and the D.C. City Council. Last week, we talked about how they put a living wage bill in D.C. with the D.C. City Council that called for a living wage of $12.50 an hour, but not for all businesses. It's for businesses that make over $1 billion, retailers that make over $1 billion in profits in sales and have a store size fee, if they even went to the size of the store, 75,000 square feet and over $1 billion in sales for that particular company. And, of course, this means that companies like Target and Costco, which is already doing it, and Walmart will have to pay at least $12.50 an hour, not minimum wage, the current $7.25 an hour. Well, out of all the companies that have to pay the $12.50 an hour, as usual, Walmart is throwing a fuss. Walmart, they just recently had their three locations open in the Washington, D.C. area. Walmart saying they're going to take their ball and go home with this living wage bill, even threatening the D.C. City Council, and they didn't cave in. The City Council put the law in place anyway with a majority vote. And Walmart is saying we're going to close down our three locations because we don't want to pay our employees $12.50 an hour. So right now, Walmart's paying, what, $7.25 an hour, $8 an hour to many of their employees. So they don't want to pay $4, $5 more an hour, even though they're the number one employer in the United States. They employ more people than any other employer, and they're making record profits. Walmart's doing fine. They're putting other competitors out of business. And even though they're doing as well as they're doing, they can't pay their employees $4 or $5 more an hour. And I say that the D.C. City Council did the right thing by not caving into their pressure, because they've tried in other cities like Chicago, not cave into their pressure, and they passed the bill anyway. And I have the notion, and I'm sure many of the members of D.C. City Council did, that we're going to do the right thing. If you don't like it, don't let the door hit you on the way out. And joining us tonight to discuss this topic is Mr. Stuart Acuff, union organizer and activist. And hello, Stuart. Thanks for joining us live on Inside Politics.
Hey, David. It's great to be with you as usual. When the D.C. City Council considered this legislation and then passed it, they sent 10 or 12 of the best suited thugs in America from Bentonville up here to Washington to say, not only are we not going to build any more stores, but we're going to pull the stores from the lowest income parts of the city, the poorest part of the city. And that's extortion. Walmart is the world's best corporation at extortion and intimidation.
And you're right. They've done this before. They did it in Chicago, and they've tried to extort officials in New York, and New York hasn't caved in. That's why there's none in New York City, thankfully. You're right. I mean, they try to intimidate politicians, buy them. If they can't buy them, then they try to extort and bully them. And the D.C. City Council stood firm, and I commend them for doing the right thing. And it was a fight just to get those three locations in the Washington, D.C. area, and I say the D.C. City Council did the right thing.
Well, absolutely, they did the right thing. They did the right thing for two reasons. One is, this is an example of a local legislative body doing what they can to protect the rights and the living standards of their constituents. And they did it within the law. It's within their purview to do that. They couldn't order, as a local city council, they couldn't amend the National Labor Relations Act, but they did. Of course, union stores are exempt from this because workers at union stores are able to negotiate their wages, negotiate their benefits, negotiate their working conditions. But at Walmart stores, nobody has a voice. They can say freely what they think they ought to make. Nobody can say freely what they want their benefits to be. Nobody can say freely what kind of schedule they want and how much flexibility they want. And so it's a real credit to the City Council of Washington. But the other reason they did it is because they had the people. people of Washington are way too smart, and this is way too expensive a city for the plantation economy of Arkansas, or the plantation mentality of Arkansas, to come in here and start ordering people around. And that's exactly what Walmart does. Their whole business model is extortion and intimidation. As you know, your listeners probably don't know this, but they bring all their vendors, fly all their vendors into Bentonville and say, if you don't lower your wages and you don't lower your costs and you don't lower your prices to us, we're going to change vendors. They had a manager 3 or 4 years ago who bragged about lowering the wage rate in China, if you can believe that. So this is standard operating procedure for Walmart to try to intimidate the city council of Washington, D.C.
Stuart, we're not live. Let me call the station. I just got a text that we're not live right now. Something happened.
Okay.
Let me put you... Well, you can stay on. Let me call the station
okay.
here. We're actually playing music right now.
Well, if you want to switch to 7:30, we can do that. Or...
Well, let me see if I
can do it.
Bob, we're not live. I just got 3 texts. Try it again. Okay, I think we're live now. And for those of you that are tuning in, we had some technical difficulties. We are live.
In the famous words of one of Bob Dylan's songs from Nashville Skyline, "You rolling, Bob?"
What the famous words of what? Oh, well, you know, it's technical difficulties. We do apologize for the technical difficulties. We are live now, and for those of you who just may have missed the first 15 minutes, talking about Walmart and the D.C. City Council not caving in to their threats, demands, and the D.C. City Council put a living wage bill of $12 an hour for retailers $1 billion in profits and have a square over 75,000 square feet, and Walmart boycott and take their ball and go home and take 3 locations and leave the city altogether, and the D.C. City Council didn't cave. So those of you that missed the first part of this and Walmart's record of intimidation coercing, if they can't buy a politician, they try to intimidate them and use threats.
And extort them. It's not just legislated by politicians, their own workers, it's their vendors, global suppliers, it's their whole business model to extort and intimidate folks. In fact, just a few weeks ago, Walmart sued the United States Commercial Workers, an organization support called Our Walmart, Council of Justice, and a single human rights activist, one person, one man, Gene Lance, all to try and intimidate. They sued him for civil harassment, which I'd never heard of, and that was for walking across their parking lots. Some of the parking lots that they're smiley, happy face and comes on TV and spends millions and millions of dollars on TV talking about make your life better, shop at Walmart. Well, what, you know, what they're really saying is help us profit off of poverty. Help us profit off the impoverishment of workers in America and all over the world. This corporation is the main driving force behind the global economic race to the bottom. And the D.C. City Council is determined not to be part of that, and they're determined to protect the rights and the living standards and the wages of their constituents. And I applaud the D.C. City Council. You want to take your stores and go home? We can live without your $7.50 or $8 an hour jobs here in Washington, D.C. In fact, we can't live on $7.50 or $8 an hour here in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, the D.C. City Council basically said you don't have to go home, but you got to get out of here. And, you know, and you know, this was a great example. And you're right, they put these commercials. I mean, there's these commercials on there saying that how great Walmart is. Well, a large part of Walmart employees are on public assistance because Walmart's, and that's not their fault. They're doing their part. They're working. They're working day to day. They're working hard. But their employer, Walmart, is not paying them a living wage. And according to one study, in terms of public assistance, the average Walmart location, if you take the average Walmart location, over $1 million. Used in public assistance at the average Walmart location.
More Walmart employees are on Medicaid than any other corporation in America. In some states, the single largest expense of Medicaid is for Walmart employees, and particularly in some southern locations where Walmart started and began 20, 30 years ago to dominate local economies.
Well, if they had truthful, honest advertising, the real commercial would be the employer in the the employee in the commercial with other employees saying, you know, I'm on public assistance. That's what Walmart's done for me.
Right, exactly. People can't get their hours. And in fact, they go this far. And this, you know, this has been proven in a court of law. They go this far. They won't pay people full time, but then they'll force them to work off the clock to finish. They won't pay, put somebody on for 40 hours, they'll put them on for 30 or 35 hours, and if it's not doing it done, they force them to work off the clock. Plus, you know, tons of evidence for gender discrimination. That doesn't even begin to talk about how much Walmart has violated the National Labor Relations Act. This is a habitual bully. It's a habitual extortionist. It's a habitual intimidator, and it's a habitual federal law violator. Proven over and over and over again, and the council's not having it.
That's true.
Not in this camp, and they're to be applauded for that.
Yeah, I think congratulations to D.C. City Council. We need more politicians, more city councils like the one in Washington in this instance. And just, you know, just for contrast, Walmart, when you compare them to other retailers, similar retailers, they pay their employees 28% than their competitors. Costco, which is a up-and-coming retailer that's really gaining a lot of momentum, Costco pays some of their employees $20 an hour, $21 an hour, $12 to start. So this living wage law, you really didn't need it for a Costco.
You didn't need it for Costco, but let's make sure that we that one of the reasons Costco allows the workers to freely choose whether they want to be in a union and negotiates in good faith with the union if workers choose to be in a union. I think last I 135% Costco is unionized. I think it's climbing all the time. You know, Safeway is a union store. Giant's a union store. The grocery industry is heavily unionized. And Walmart's been trying to drive those good companies that negotiate with their employees, pay better wages, treat people fairly, treat people as human beings and not as automatons, has been trying to drive them out of business. Just like 20 and 30 years ago, Walmart closed down small-town business district by underbidding and undermining the indigenous local business in small towns. So there's no valid, objective, economic reason to do business the way Walmart does. Because, as you say, David, Costco has a very different business model that is not only working for them, it's helping them thrive.
Yeah, they're a great example of how when you do things right and you're not greedy and you treat your employees right, allow them the right to unionize, not only do your workers have a living wage and are treated with dignity, but you're still successful. And I think that's what Walmart needs to look at, is look at the Costco model. You can pay your employees a living wage, give them a choice to be in a union, treat them with dignity, and still do well. And I think, you know, Walmart is just all about greed. And another thing they've done is studies have shown that, there was one study to show that when Walmart opens, it takes out the small businesses in the community. When a Walmart opens near an area with a certain mile radius, small businesses in that area have a 40% chance of being closed down because of that Walmart.
Absolutely. I mean, you can drive across the South, and of course, you know, David, I'm from Tennessee, and I worked a lot in Texas, and Texas was one of the first places Walmart started building stores. And you can see vacant downtowns and downtown business districts while Walmart's sucking up whatever poor people's money they can out on the edge of town. This is their business model. And, you know, I'm a Southerner, you're a Southerner, lots of your listeners are Southerners. I don't mean this as a negative about the South, but Walmart operates with the classic old-fashioned plantation mentality, which is don't treat your workers as human beings, treat them like you would treat a mule, work them until they drop, and pay them just enough that they can eat so they can get back to work tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm a transplant in the South, but it's close enough. But you're right. I mean, Walmart has actually done, I mean, the new talking point by conservative media that Fox, the Wall Street Journal is pushing, because let's face it, they are the corporations. That's who's funding them. The new talking point is that Walmart is actually good for for the poor. That they're actually, I've actually heard one Wall Street Journal shellacky say that Walmart's actually done more to help poverty, help people in low income jobs, than any social program. And I say, really? No, it's Walmart. Walmart's the reason we need social programs.
That's exactly right. This is, your listeners need to know, this is dangerous business. I mean, Walmart is the major driving force behind the economic race to the bottom that is occurring all over the world. And we can ruin, or Walmart and other corporations similar to Walmart can ruin not only the American economy, but the entire world economy by continuing to force down wages and continuing to force down living standards of people around the world. There was a time in America when people understood that what was good for workers in America was good for the country. And that greatest economy in the history of the world. But Walmart and other actors and players like Walmart have destroyed that kind of thinking amongst right-wing economists and the radical right-wing Republican Party. And it's destroying the living standards of workers all over America.
Yeah, and there's a huge problem when the number one employer in the United States is also one of the lowest employers in the United States. That's not good for your economy.
Not good at all. I mean, you dry up consumer demand. Even Henry Ford said he wanted to pay his people enough that they could afford to buy the cars that they made. Walmart doesn't see it that way. When you dry up consumer demand, it means that people cannot afford to buy things. And it means that you dry up the retail industry and you eventually dry up the economy. You can't base an economy on millionaires. They don't spend every dime they make like working people do. By the time a working person gets home on a Friday with their paycheck, 90% of it's already spent. And none of us like living week to week. The fact is that when people spend money, it benefits everybody, including the entire economy. And Walmart doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
Walmart works on bullying, intimidation, and extortion.
And it's bad all the way around for everybody in the U.S. economy. It's bad for small businesses, your mom and pop, small businesses in the areas, local economy. It's bad for workers. It's bad for taxpayers. It's bad for funding of social programs. But that if Walmart paid their employees the money that they deserve, they wouldn't have to get public assistance. Now, there's anything wrong with that.
Right.
They're doing the right thing. And it's bad for, as you mentioned, quality of demand. It's bad for goods. Walmart has brought down the quality of goods because Walmart is offering lower prices, but it's cheaper quality goods. So it's bad. And then internationally, we know what's happened in Bangladesh with some of the garment factories and some of factories that have collapsed, burnings due to poor working conditions, fatalities in Bangladesh and other factories overseas. I mean, Walmart is...
Indonesia.
I mean, it's
go down the list.
It's bad internationally. It's bad for local small businesses. Bad for our national economy. It has not done anything to help poverty, regardless of what Fox says. It's a driving force in poverty, and one of the reasons why our income gap is wider than it's ever been in our nation's history. So Walmart is bad all the way around.
That's exactly right. All the way around, and it's bad for the, as we said, the global economy. I mean, it's a habitual federal law violator as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's been one of the biggest union-busting corporations. And we haven't even got, I mean, we can go through another hour or two, Stuart. They're on the board. Walmart is on the board of ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is corporations that write the bills at the state level. All these state bills that you're seeing, write the word bills, stand your ground, abortion bills, all these shenanigans at the state level are copycat bills, immigration, environmental deregulations. It's all being done by ALEC in his corporations writing the copycat bills with the help of state legislators across the country. And Walmart is on the board.
Yes.
Of ALEC.
But Walmart, they've got more heat coming this summer. There is a growing movement against Walmart's violations and against Walmart's business practices. People of faith, human rights activists, workers' rights activists, unions, and others are building pressure on Walmart all over America.
Yeah, people are fed up. And a lot of their workers are fed up, and they're starting to have protests at their national headquarters and at regular store locations. You're right. People are fed up. They've been exposed for what they are. Alec has been exposed. Walmart has been exposed. And, you know, I think one of the things that is going to come out of this tragedy, has already come out of the tragedy in Trayvon Martin, not to change subjects, is that last year alone, when people saw that they were behind standard ground laws, 46 corporations, not enough, but it's a start, 46 corporations dropped. And I think that's what we need to do from this tragedy, is use this energy to boycott these corporations that are part of ALEC and force them to drop ALEC, including Walmart. Don't shop at Walmart. I haven't shopped at Walmart in years, and I'm not going to until they stop exploiting their workers both here at home and internationally. I can't tell others what to do, but I know what I'm doing, and I'm not shopping at Walmart.
And I think that's a great idea. And if you do go to Walmart, be sure and tell somebody they ought to have a union. And watch how quickly you get kicked out of Walmart. They don't like to tell their workers the truth.
don't come in with a pro-union T-shirt.
Right.
But Stuart, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure, as always, and talk to you next week.
Great. Thanks a million, David. Appreciate you an awful lot. Take care.
Thanks. And we're about to hit into a commercial break, and we'll be right back. Don't forget to email the show at insidepolitics@ymail.com. Also, check us out on Facebook, Inside Politics with David Califf on Facebook. We'll be right back after this quick commercial break.
And now.
Hello, this is David.
Hey, David.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, how about you?
Good again. I'm going to do one quick commercial, and we'll get right back to it.
Sounds good.
Right now, I'm standing in a hole, a 300-foot deep hole to be exact. But even though I'm down here, I'm still connected to the entire job site because I have the new Sprint Direct Connect with apps like Workforce Locator that lets me know my foreman, Mike, is...
Yeah, I'm here.
And I have three times the coverage, so I know that my most important delivery...
Just arrived.
And as part of the fastest push-to-talk, I can assemble my team the moment I need them. Guys?
On our way.
So now I can focus on turning this hole into a hotel.
Upgrade to the new Done. The new Sprint Direct Connect with three times the coverage and access to the fastest push-to-talk experience nationwide. Now when you buy one Motorola Admiral Rugged smartphone for $49.99, you'll get one free. To upgrade, call 800-SPRINT-1 or visit a Sprint store near you. Offer ends 1/10/13. Offer available to corporate liable accounts. Excludes taxes. Two-year agreement. $36 activation. Up to $350 early termination fee for devices. Fastest claim based on initial setup time for push-to-talk calls originating in Nextel or Sprint-owned 3G coverage. Coverage claim based on comparison of Nextel National Network square miles to Sprint National Network inclusive of roaming. Restrictions apply. See store.
The going gets tough. The tough get going.
And you are Inside Politics with David Califf, the show that covers the issues that affect you. And hope everybody's having a great Tuesday evening. Before we get back into tonight's show, one of the jurors in the Trayvon Martin trial has given an interview today and made some controversial comments, pretty much stepped in you know what. And one of the comments that this juror made was she said that she thinks that Zimmerman should be allowed. She's for Zimmerman being part of the neighborhood watch again. I'm not making this up. Check out the tape. She says that George Zimmerman, she's for him being back in the neighborhood watch. She also said it didn't bother her that Zimmerman has a history of turning in African American names that he thinks suspect to the police. He has a history of doing this. And she, you know, the thing that troubled me, and we'll get more into some of her comments later in the show, was that saying that he should still be part of Neighborhood Watch. So that's the message to everybody out there. If Zimmerman's allowed to be back in the Neighborhood Watch, don't wear a hoodie. And Pat Robertson, Also, he's a so-called religious man as part of the 700 Club, evangelical preacher. Pat Robertson says that Zimmerman was right to follow Trayvon Martin because criminals wear hoodies. Well, no, it's funny that people like Pat Robertson and people in conservative media, they get outraged whenever you say that this case was about racial profiling, and yet they make comments every day that is exactly that, racial profiling. But we'll get more into that a little bit later in the show, but wanted to weigh in also on the filibuster reform. There was breaking news earlier today that the Senate has made, it reached a deal on filibuster reforms to stop the nuclear option. And just a little bit of context, the filibuster has been abused, especially since President Obama has taken in as president. The last Congress used the filibuster more than any other Congress in history. They filibustered a number of different bills, including the DREAM Act, some of the president's jobs initiatives, just to name a few. They threatened to filibuster many things if they didn't get their way, including extending unemployment insurance benefits on two different occasions since this president has taken office. And also, there's a number of judicial nominations that have been put on hold and have been on hold for over a year. Judicial nominations that the president nominated, and it's been over a year, and they haven't gotten their up or down vote, including a whole agency. There's a new agency called the Consumer Protections Bureau, Financial Consumer Protections Bureau, put in place to be a watchdog against something like the banks and student loan companies, just to name a few. They filibustered Elizabeth Warren, which led to her being a senator of Massachusetts because she later decided to run for senator. So that backfired in their face. But the person who was later nominated, other than Elizabeth Warren, Richard Cordray, he has not taken over the agency, even though he was a nomination to be the first head of the agency. So you have an agency that hasn't been able to be started because of the filibuster, where you need 60 supermajority votes instead of the majority 51. And our founding fathers never intended the filibuster to be used as a way of governing. The filibuster was always used as a way in emergency situations to stop those in power from abusing power. It was never meant to be used the way it's been used now. So Harry Reid, fed up with over 6-7 nominations being held up over a year, Harry Reid said, we're going to do a nuclear option. So that's when McConnell and company threw a tizzy, and they met today and over the last couple hours, and they've met agreement where now many of these nominations will be nominated. And they were outraged about filibuster reform, and I have to quote Harry Reid, if you don't want filibuster reform, quit using the filibuster. Joining us live tonight to discuss this topic is Mr. Bill Atkins. And hello, Bill. Thanks for joining us live on Inside Politics.
Hey, Dave. Glad to be here. You know, a lot of people recognize the filibuster as it's being abused in this circumstance. And they think about a number of nominations like judges and such. But we're talking about, in this filibuster nuclear rule deal they just made, they're only talking about executive branch positions, those appointments as cabinet secretaries or agency heads. One, you really have to point out the real symptom of abuse of this Congress as to this filibuster circumstance is that they blocked 16 of President Obama's nominees for executive branch positions using the filibuster. Now, contrast to that, only 20 executive branch nominees were filibustered under all previous presidents combined. All previous presidents combined, Obama being number 44. So 43 presidents, only 20. President Obama, 16. I mean, it's unbelievable that they've gotten away with this. And I'm glad that they reached this accord to the degree that they have, but, you know, I kind of regret they didn't pull the trigger on this nuclear option, particularly as to judges. There are so many vacant judge positions, federal judges' positions across this nation. And not to mention the fact that Congress has failed to fund such a lot of either being cut back justice.
And I think Harry Reid did the right thing. He was trying to make up for a wrong, because you can change the rules of the Senate at the beginning of a session. In the last two times, Harry Reid had a chance to do filibuster reform, and he didn't. So Harry Reid also has to, you know, to be fair, also has to blame himself, because he could have done it when he had the votes as well. But I'm glad, finally, he's saying that there has to be reform. You can't work with these people. These people are extremists, hostage takers, and you have to do the right thing. And these nominations have been waiting for over a year. I mean, that's...
I don't know why it's taking so long. I think at least one nominee waited almost 2 years. I think Gray waited almost 2 years. And others, at least a year. And I don't know why Harry Reid waited so long. This is a reflection of the health care back in 2009. You know, you can reach your hand across the aisle so many times before you figure out that it's being chewed off. And that's what's happening here. And consider, too, in 2005, it was Mitch McConnell talking about this, doing the very same thing that Reid has proposed. So, you know, McConnell, not surprisingly, speaks out of both sides of his mouth on this issue.
Definitely. And that was breaking news from earlier. And so these nominations will be put in place. So there looks like there won't be a nuclear option. There won't be any, you know, there's a deal met where these nominations will be confirmed. And it's a shame because these nominations have been a year, 2 years, not just judicial judge nominations, not just Richard Corday, but also NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, two nominees that have been obstructed as well. And just for more context, this president has had the slowest number of judges since John F. Kennedy. Remember what happened to John F. Kennedy.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, the hostility of today certainly gives you pause and concern.
Definitely. But I wanted to ask you, the country's really talking about this verdict from over the weekend, and where Zimmerman was found not guilty, and it seems like there's many people that don't want to admit that we have a unjust legal system. And I know you're a trial attorney, you're a lawyer, you can really give some context to it as well. But Think Progress put an amazing set of statistics from a lot of different sources, including the New York Times, National Council on Crime and Delinquency, the American Bar Association, that a black male born in 2001 has a 32% chance of spending some portion of their life in prison. In major American cities, 80% of young African-American men have criminal records. African-Americans who use drugs are more than four times as likely to be incarcerated than whites who use drugs, according to the American Bar Association. In seven states, African-Americans constitute 80% or more of all drug offenders sent to prison. Black students are 3.5 times as likely to be suspended or expelled than their white peers in the school system. Black youths are referred to juvenile courts, much more likely to be detained, referred to adult court, or end up in adult prisons, tried as adults, than their white counterparts, according to the National Council on Crime and Delinquency. In the United States, imprisons a larger percentage of its black population than South Africa did at the height of apartheid. These are amazing statistics. For those that don't think that there's an unequal legal system here in the United States, following the Trayvon Martin trial, brought a lot more attention to that. The facts.
A lot of issues out there, but you're absolutely right. Just talking about the disenfranchisement of African Americans and how many are incarcerated. You know, this nation incarcerates more citizens than just about any other nation or combination of nations on the globe, more than China. Yet we are the beacon of democracy and freedom. I think you really have to look hard at that reputation. Blacks having lost the right to vote because drug offenses, felony offenses, particularly in the federal system and certainly in the state system. Kentucky, where I live, attorney, incarcerates, is high on the list of states for incarceration in a nation that is highest on the globe. And certainly there's a racial component to it. And you asked about the Zimmerman case. You know, the bigger issue here, I think, is that I watched it, and I saw some issues with the law and what each side had done. But what I found striking and disturbing was the concern for justice wasn't there. Race was the issue. You had people cheering for the white guy, the Hispanic white guy. You had people cheering for the black guy. But it wasn't justice, it was race. And the progression, I'm old enough to recall the 60s and the Civil Rights Act, the Civil Rights Struggle, rather. And the regression over the last few years on this issue is amazing. And amazing, surprising, disappointing. It's truly surprising. But I think that's what surprised and disappointed me most, that it wasn't just people were worried about. It was race. some of them got out. You know, in Kentucky, we have Asselberg. You come in my house, and I feel threatened. You're likely to be carried out because the castle doctrine will defend that person, that exaction against a home invader. In Florida, the difference is stand your ground. If you feel threatened anywhere, say in a subdivision in Sanford, Florida, you can use deadly force. But I got a problem with a guy that goes to it like Zimmerman did, and then pulls the trigger on a 17-year-old. There's a mix of responsibilities here, but that issue alone, I thought that we might see a manslaughter verdict, but then you heard the jurors, the all-white female jurors, one of which I think you told me tonight, he said, well, Zimmerman ought to be back out there on the street being a guardian or whatever, a vigilante, whatever he was doing.
That's definitely amazing that one of the things we took from this CNN interview with this juror, one of the things that this juror said was that she believes that George Zimmerman should continue to serve on as the neighborhood watchman, and she says it's because he has learned his lesson about going too far. Learned your lesson? What, after someone's life was taken away? That's a lesson we don't want people to learn that way.
He might have learned the lesson, but Trayvon Martin paid the tuition. that's a bit extreme. You know, what we're seeing by the fervor over this, the racial fervor over, not dissimilar from the O.J. trial, really, in terms of that, but it wasn't quite as pronounced back then, I don't think. But today, in the environment in which we operate politically, particularly, I'm seeing a fabric of the political right that seems to want to mainstream racism. See, Rand Paul, 2010, talking to Rachel Maddow, saying that he was not comfortable with that part of the Civil Rights Act, as the discrimination in commercial locations like restaurants. The property owner, he said, should be able to decide, and then the free market will decide if that property owner stays in business. Well, you know, I call that the less dramatic school of civil rights, and I don't think it worked then, and I don't think it would work now. Now we've got Rand Paul with his Southern Avenger friend, a guy who's a rabid Confederate neo-secessionist who thinks that Unwell Booth was a really good marksman and did a good job, and criticized as being the worst president. But he's on Rand Paul's paid staff. He's one of his aides. Of course, he inherited this guy, Rand Paul did, from his father, Ron Paul. But they really do seem to want to mainstream racism and make it somewhat acceptable. You know, I'm not buying that. I don't want America to buy that. And it's rather frightening that people would say that. You know, I often say all partiers are not racist. But you know, a portion of racists are Tea Partiers.
Oh, yeah, I think that's a great quote. I mean, not Republicans are racist. So,
I understand that when signed the Civil Rights Act, he turned to Bill Moyers and said, I just handed to the Republican Party for a generation. I think he was right. And Nixon's Southern strategy is a reflection of that. But I also know that Nixon's Southern strategy, the guy that came up with it, said, look, it's like Yamamoto and Pearl Harbor in the United States. You're going to wallow for a while, but eventually you're going to lose. And that's what's going to happen because whites are becoming more and more assimilated to the race and becoming a minority. Maybe the largest minority, but still get a minority. And with some of that, I think there's fear because for so long there's been an entitlement to govern, and that seems to be going away.
And I think that's one of the things with this case that no one seems to want to get to the crux of it is that this was racial profiling. And I think that's why the feds and Eric Holder and the DOJ are looking into and doing their investigations of rights violations because, I mean, the question that I've asked to other guests and callers on other shows and so many people since this verdict, the question that we posed is, if Trayvon was, if his name was Travis, and he had blonde hair, and he was walking down the street, and at that same time of night, would Zimmerman have followed him? And nobody can say yes. Not one person that I've asked this question to has been able to say, yes, Zimmerman would have followed this person if his name was Travis and he was Caucasian.
Well, let's assume that Von Travis was walking in that neighborhood and he was approached by black George Zimmerman as a neighborhood watch person. And this situation had occurred and Von Travis had been killed. How do you think that trial would have come? I don't think it would have gone well, George, in that circumstance.
Yeah, and you're right. If the roles were reversed and then there's been some cases, and I think that's one of the reasons that people are really worried about, a lot of prosecutors are worried about these standard ground laws. And by the way, it hasn't made these states safer. According to the Washington Post, states with standard ground laws are actually have higher homicide rates than states without standard ground laws. So it hasn't really deterred crime or homicides in these states at all. And then when you look at these cases that you mentioned where it was the opposite, where it was an African-American using standard ground against someone of Caucasian skin tone. One example was a case back in 2006 where there was a 50-year-old African-American male who shot a 17-year-old Caucasian after an altercation. He used the same standard ground offense, and he was found guilty of manslaughter. Or this case in the same state, Florida, where there was an African-American woman who, Marissa Alexander, fired a warning shot off someone who, by the way, was had a history of domestic violence against her. And she tried to use standard self-defense, the claim of self-defense, like standard ground that Zimmerman walked free on. She was found guilty, and she's now serving 20 years in jail, mandatory, for this crime. And she just fired shots. She didn't kill anybody, shoot anybody. She fired warning shots into the ear. And she was prosecuted and convicted for 20 years for shooting for those shots into the air. And then another case, John McNeil, back in 2005, similar situation. He's where there was a 19-year-old Caucasian that he shot, and he used a standard ground offense, and he was convicted as well. So I think that's got people really outraged about these standard ground laws. It seems like it's not even unjust when it comes to the standard ground laws in self-defense situations based on previous cases that we can pull from.
Well, the concept of deadly force has always been of self-defense has always been relative to the degree of force applied against the victim. Unless it was deadly force, that means you can use a similar force against someone. Someone comes at you with a knife and you have a gun or a knife, and you're pretty much justified in using it against them. Someone comes at you with a pillow threatening to fight you and you pull a 45, you might have overstepped. And I think that by putting these into the statutes the way they have, about a method of abuse, I don't think that based upon what we hear here and what we've seen, that was able to demonstrate deadly force was being applied. He was able to demonstrate perhaps that it was a fist fight and that he was losing because, as I heard, George Zimmerman's martial arts trainer said that he would not permit Zimmerman to shadow box for fear the shadow would win. But hopefully, I'm not certain that really without the statute, Zimmerman would have made any portion of his case, and without the public fervor that was more related to race than justice.
Yeah, and that's what so many people around the country are saying, that he should have at least gotten the manslaughter charge.
Well, what has happened to this nation that an unarmed individual is killed by someone who's armed with an automatic pistol, and he's viewed as the aggressor? You know, a 17-year-old, and best I can tell you, was a rather small 17-year-old.
Well, I thought he was 16.
Says he was
7, but we're talking about a minor. George Zimmerman's an adult, over 30 years old. We're talking about a 30-year-old grown adult male and a minor. The grown adult male has a gun. He gets out of his car, chases Trayvon Martin. You know, and I've been saying this for countless weeks. If anybody should use self-defense or stand your ground, it was Trayvon Martin.
I think you're right. Because, again, it was Zimmerman who got out of the car. Zimmerman who confronted Trayvon Martin, not the other way around. So it was Zimmerman who sparked the confrontation. And I think that's where all lies. Zimmerman's not through yet. There'll be a civil case, like O.J., who lost a large part of his wealth. Zimmerman, I understand, has a defense fund that might be vulnerable to Trayvon Martin's family, and I think that's going to go. And I think it's righteous. That's justice, okay? Let's assume that I had to respect the jury. You know, the O.J. trial, regardless of who thinks that O.J. was guilty, that was done. Casey Anthony, trial's done. Zimmerman, trial is done. But that's not to say we can't comment on these issues that we've received. And again, it comes back to what I fear is the mainstreaming of racism and desensitizing people to it.
Yeah, that's what could be the travesty out of this is that what we've seen from conservative media, Sean Hannity's of the world, Pat Robertson's, you know, across the board, is it's become a dirty word. Well, they try to silence you or threaten you or say, how dare you use the word racial profiling. Look, you know, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And one of the things we're going to do on this show is we're always going to tell you, the listeners, the truth. And in this instance, and we're not ones to say, you know, use the word racism loosely that follow this show. This is all about telling the truth, the facts. This was racial profiling, and I think we have to, as a nation, talk about a system that is unjust, not just in terms of race, but in terms of income, class. Let's face it, you know, poor, low-income minorities, Latinos, poor whites, poor African-Americans don't have the same justice as people with higher incomes in this country. And that's a problem. Standard ground laws is too vague. We need to look at these standard ground laws, which was pushed by the NRA, pushed by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. And I think that's what we need to take from this case is use this energy, use this attention to this case, this verdict, and use it constructively to look at how can we change our legal system, how can we change our system, our legal system, our laws, and that we need to start talking about race. There's nothing wrong with talking, and I think that's one of the things that's happened, and you point out, as many in the right have done, it's become almost taboo where you can't talk about race or racial profiling. There's nothing wrong about talking about it. If you don't talk about it, you don't get it out in the open, then it's always going to stay in the back, and you're going to have incidents like this. We have to tackle.
People start out a conversation by saying, I'm not a racist, but, you know, if you got to say the but, then you probably are.
Yeah.
You talk about the factors by which you recognize the duck. Let's talk about the duck. Let's talk about these instances. Talk about in the 30s when there were Jews in Germany who said, you know, Hitler talks a lot, but he doesn't really mean it. Well, they found out he did. Well, let's talk about people like Rand Paul, and I'm particularly concerned about this because, you know, the civil rights issue that I talked about before, Rachel Maddow. His appearing before Howard University, mangling history and rationalizing away reality as discrimination and basically trying to tell people who knew what was right about history that they were wrong about it, that it was the KKK was still yet democratic. Keep in mind that KKK is now in the CCC in the South, the Conservative Citizens Group. Then you go on to the Southern Avenger that Rand Paul has associated himself with. This is a series of obvious acts.
Look at Pat Robertson. Pat
Robertson. What he is. What I'm afraid of is, why don't people recognize Rand Paul for what he is? Must he stand in front of a door to convince them and say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever? I think it's about time to recognize exactly where the poison and darkness is in this so-called fake libertarian movement led by someone like Rand Paul.
Yeah, and Pat Robertson today. Pat Robertson said that Zimmerman was right to go after Trayvon because of the hoodie. That's the new notion now. You know, I've worn a hoodie in the past. Does that make me a criminal? You know, I think it's unbelievable. It's almost like these people, you wonder, do they even know what racial profiling is? Or are they just plain dumb?
Off the hoodie, he might have gotten by with whatever he was attempting to do in their world, perceiving Trayvon as wrong. So I guess, you know, you're going to have to start seeing the hoodie that's up there. And I'm starting to see the hoods and sheets that aren't there on the right.
Yeah, yeah. And if they want, if that's what they want, why don't they go and rewrite the rule books? Because according to them, it's against the law to wear a hoodie, the way that they're talking. So, you know, why don't they get together with Alec and rewrite the rules and make it against the law to wear a hoodie? Because according to them, that's, if you wear a hoodie, you're a criminal.
Exactly. You know, and rewrite the rules is talking about the other issue of disenfranchisement, because you might have crack, which would get you a longer sentence a few years ago, rather than powder cocaine. And yeah, crack was predominantly used by African Americans.
And
that disenfranchised millions of young black males primarily, but males and females.
And the American Bar Association...
Well, democratic is what philosophy is.
Right, and the American Bar Association has put out some recommendation, you probably know about this, a couple years back, on how we can make some changes to our legal system to stop this gap. And I mean, we ran through a number of stats. If you don't think there's an unjust legal system in this country, well, I mean, that's a long list that we went through. But you're right. I think, you know, the American Bar Association put out some reforms, and maybe we can, next time you're on the show, talk about that, some things that we can do as a country to try to fix some of these gaps in our justice system.
I think you have to, because the disparity will breed more and more contempt, more and more violence, more and more tension. And I don't think it's worth it, because it's a disparity that's used by the few to maintain power over them. And ultimately, yeah, I'm the kind of guy who likes people. I don't see your color. Certainly you can pick someone out of a crowd because of their color. But I don't see your color. I like people. I don't, your race has to do with it. I just don't like it. Or I do like it. And that's what we've got to get. It's a colorblind society, a real-life colorblind society, has to value people for who and what they are and what they do.
And that's a great point.
A deep notion that that person is wearing a hoodie and they are black. You put those two together, you've got a criminal.
And that's a great point. And that's why we have to call out the people that are doing the racial profiling. Call out the people that are, because they're in the minority. The majority of the American people do not have these views. It's the few bad actors like the Rand Pauls, the Pat Robertsons, and their followers that are trying to divide this country. They're the ones dividing the country. And I think we have to call out the ones that are doing the racial profiling. And we have to also point out to many Americans that when we say racial profiling, we're not saying all Caucasians who have done it, or all African Americans, or all of this group, or all that group. It's a small group percentage, but it's too many. And what we have to do is ostracize this group, put them in a corner, and call them out when they do it, and also have a dialogue about this topic. If we don't, we're going to continue to avoid a huge problem in this country.
This is class warfare, however. It really is class warfare. It's not really race as much as it's class warfare. What we have here are poor whites and poor blacks and poor Hispanics who make up a large group, but they're divided by these racial factors or ethnic factors. These people together, their interests are in common. They'd be a great power with the nation, a voting block that would stay forever, I think.
Oh, yeah, there's way...
These issues to divide and really to conquer, and we've got to fight that.
And there's way more of us than we are them, and we have to let so many Americans know that, you know, they're not... These people are not part of the American mainstream. Their ideas, their ideologies, that's why they lose the national elections. Their ideologies, their way of what they think about this country, what they think about America, is not in tune with the American value. It's not in tune with most Americans. And we got to continue to call them out, because there's way more of us than they are of them. Bill, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. It's an interesting topic that we're going to confront if other shows want to continue to ignore.
Hey, I enjoyed it, David. Thank you very much. We'll see you next time.
Oh, same here. It's been a pleasure. Have a good one. And that's it for tonight's show. You've been listening to Inside Politics. Until next time, I'm out. The Tough Get Going.